Hello and welcome to another episode of the Football Faithful Podcast. My name's Sam Steen and we're a little bit late this week. So we're not going to delve into the actual game specifically because, well, you probably know the results and you've probably heard bits and pieces about them. But this week I think we're going to talk just a bit more generally about the league and where the teams are and why there's such a massive gap there and what that actually means. Joining me to go through all that is Anthony Kelly. I'll start with you, Ant. Hi, Ant.
Hello, mate. How you doing?
Not too bad. Colin Boog's there as well. Hi, Col.
Hi, all.
And Deck Coleman's there too. Hi, Deck.
Hello.
How's things?
Yeah, not bad, mate. Not bad. I feel all important because you said my name first this week.
Sorry. I've thrown you out completely. I suppose, actually, I'll go to you just for a second there, Ant, because a bit of housekeeping. We've got a new podcast out. So if you're already subscribed to the Football Faithful feed on whatever thing you follow us on, you'll have seen this already. It's basically a weekly look back at the 90s and the footballers that, well, we think made it really good. Hosted by Steve McGovern. And, of course, you were on it for this week's episode, which is all about Andrei Kanchelskis, my favourite player from the 90s.
Yeah, it was a good old chat about him, actually. He was a really interesting fella to talk about. And very of his time. In the 90s, you know, just discuss whether he was worthy of being in the world famous Football Faithful Hall of Fame for the 90s, which he was. You know, I'll let you guys listen and tune in to see how we came up with that decision. But he was, he's a very interesting guy and kind of a nice trip down memory lane for you for midweek as well. So yeah, get listening, folks.
Absolutely, really good. Do check that one out, and there'll be another one out next week as well. About Andrei Kanchelskis, I remember getting him on the back of my United jersey, and then he was sold about 3 months later. So that's my Andrei Kanchelskis story.
Mr. Moneybags.
How much did it cost to get him in the back of jersey? It wasn't a real jersey, don't worry about it.
Black market jersey.
Oh, big sale, yeah.
Yeah, it was black pen. It was black tape, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I just wrote it on myself with a Sharpie. Right, let's get going then. And, well, we'll start as we always do normally with the moment of the week. And, Carl, I'll start with you.
My one, like, it was tempting to go with Jose Mourinho's reaction to Raheem Sterling.
Oh, that was my favourite bit of the season, I think.
Yeah, with Joe Sacramento telling him. And then him running at the assistant. I thought it was great. But I'm going to go for a hipster moment of the week, right?
Okay.
And how hipster is this? I'm going to choose my moment of the week as Gerard Deulofeu's first touch for his assist for Adam Messina's goal. Watford 1-0 up against Everton. It was brilliant.
Yeah, that was an absolute fifth first touch there.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Yeah. Etienne Capoue sprays the ball, centre mid out to the left wing. It looks like it's overhit. It's one of those first touches that if the ball had gone out of play, you wouldn't have blamed Deulofeu for not controlling it. But he does better than that. He flicks it with his right foot back into his path, so he's facing the right way, and then plays a nice little ball into Adam Messina, who scores his first goal for Watford. Definitely my moment of the week.
I'd say it made you spit your craft beer out over your copy of Mundial.
Oh, my man one fell down. It was so good.
Deck, what about you?
Mine is actually something from the Watford game as well, but mine is the moment when Everton scored their goal that turned out to be the winning goal, because I just think it's brilliant that Nigel Pearson is just having a bit of a fucking heart attack and it's all starting to go to shit for him, because as we know, I really like him. So I'm glad that it's starting to go a bit shit for him. I think there was a point in the interview afterwards as well where he was like, we're just going to have a little chat inside afterwards. You know he's going to go in and he's probably going to pick somebody up and just rip his head clean off his shoulder. So yeah, I thought that was good.
Good. Very nice. And Ant?
I was going to go for Mourinho. I've watched it about 55 times. It's like the gif that keeps on gifing, if you like, isn't it? That one, it's so good. Like, yeah, it's so good. But it's probably my moment of the season, not thus far, just how funny it was, his reaction. So I don't know if I can go for that one. I'm going to go for a bit of a sickly sweet one this week, lads. I don't know if anybody would have seen it, because the BBC, in their infantile wisdom, ceased broadcasting of Liverpool versus Shrewsbury in the FA Cup because he got a strop on with Klopp not turning up. But I was able to get it on my totally legal stream that I found last night. And just seeing James Milner at the match supporting the lads. I know there was a lot about Klopp and a lot of negative press about that game. But after the game, Neil Critchley was saying that he was, Milner was training with the young lads earlier on in the run-up to the game. He was really, really being encouraging. He even asked Neil Critchley's permission if he could rock up and show some support in the night and be in the dressing room with them. And apparently he was really vocal and really helping them out. And I just thought that was really top work from a pro. I think everyone, even like sort of non-neutral fans, would have to take that off to Milner. He's an absolute gem of a pro. So I thought that was brilliant. A bit of a sickly sweet one, but love to see it. Absolutely brilliant work from him.
Imagine if the manager of the club had showed up.
Yeah,
enough on that. Right, let's just move on. Well, we'll actually stick with Liverpool then. I suppose, I mean, obviously they won again. They're 22 points clear in the league. And, Andrew, are you ever going to say that they're going to win it?
No.
Come on now. Come on.
No.
Just stop this shit. I mean, it's just getting ridiculous now. Now it's just annoying because, like, you know it's going to happen and now you're just, like, willfully...
Well, you don't know what it's like, Sam, to finish second with 97 fucking points. So when you experience that, then you can know how I fucking feel, okay? No, what you'll get out of me is it will take something catastrophically wrong for us to mess this up from here. That's what you'll get out of me, like, you know what I mean? I had a bit of a mild panic attack when that second goal went in for Spurs because it all got very real. It was like, crap, we are 6 games away from winning the league. If we win these 6 games, we'd be champions in March or whatever it is. It's just absolutely bonkers on this band out. Until I see Henderson lift it, I think even myself, I just won't, something in me won't believe it until I see Henderson lift the trophy. Like, I can't get hurt again, Sam. I can't get hurt.
Colin, what do you make of this? I mean, the 22 points thing is mad. It's the biggest lead that there's ever been. It very well may continue to grow before they win the league, and I don't know, maybe they'll lay off at that stage. But is this, I mean, obviously it's not normal, but is it because they have such a lead that the lead continues to grow or stays like this, that the other teams have kind of thrown in the towel?
Yeah, you build up this, I suppose you call it superiority complex. Like, Southampton actually did very well at the weekend and they had chances, and I think it was scoreless at half-time. Then you had that Danny Ings shot that hit off Shane Long en route to goal. Joe Gomez was able to afford to make a potentially catastrophic error, and Southampton didn't capitalise. And then Liverpool are just ruthless. I mean, they don't really have to play brilliant most of the time because Liverpool at 55 to 60%, it turns out, is a better side than the 19 others. And that's probably the most concerning for the rest of us. Even more worrying, I suppose, is that it's really difficult to find a bad word to say about Liverpool. That's worrying.
Yeah. No, I mean, we kind of touched on it at the end of the pod last time out, Deck. And that's that all of the other teams, bar City, but even then when you kind of look a little bit deeper, all of the other teams that would be chasing Liverpool seem to be in the middle of or about to get into massive rebuilding jobs with regard to in some cases, the squad, and another team, in other cases, the entire club.
Yeah, like, I suppose it's funny when you say that, like, you think about Man City, and a lot of talk was about how they were losing David Silva, and for most of the season up until a few weeks ago, Fernandinho leaving, and obviously he signed a new contract and stuff, and it was going to be a catastrophe that they were losing these two players in their mid-30s, you know, which is Man City's own fault, really, that they're in a predicament, because they've had the money to spend. They have spent it. They have what has been regarded as the best manager in the world for a long time. And they've just probably failed to reach their own standards that they've set for themselves. As far as the other teams go, I mean, Chelsea, we know the situation they're in, and we've spoken about that a number of times on the pod, and they're probably delighted with the position they're in. And it's in fairness, it's probably a testament to how good of a job Frank Lampard has been doing, that they're now starting to say that they're in a prickly situation, and they should be aiming higher, like, because of how well they started and got off to a good start this season. Like, Leicester are, you could say, overachieving. So it's... I think
Chelsea are still Chelsea are still 32 points off the top of the table.
Yeah, I know, but, like, I mean, the thing about the Premier League for years is it's been the best league in the world because any team can beat any other team, and that has been the like one of the cornerstones of the Premier League, that people are always championing the fact that it's the best league in the world because it's so competitive and everyone can beat everyone else. This season is probably, if you took Liverpool away from it, there'd be no argument about how poor teams are doing. I don't think it would just be, Jesus Christ, the Premier League is just showing how good and competitive it is because you've Sheffield United and Wolves are doing so well. They're beating teams all around them. Other teams are taking points off each other left, right and centre. Every team except for Norwich, really, I suppose. But that's been the thing that people say, why the Premier League is better than La Liga, better than Bundesliga and all that. And I think it's... Liverpool are just the one team that no team is... Well, okay, one team has taken points off. So they're not dropping points. And it's kind of... It's skewing what the perception is a little bit, I think, because it's still a really enjoyable league to watch. If you watch any other game in the Premier League, most of the time, bar if you're watching Man United play, because they're fucking dreadful to watch, but every other team is... Their matches are exciting to watch. And you never know which team is going to win. And it's always, you know... spells in a game where one team looks like they could be comfortably a top four team, and then they go through a period where the other team in that game is having a same spell and they could be a top four team. And I think it's probably testament to how good Liverpool are doing. And I think it just needs to be noted a bit more, because a lot of people seem to be taken away from the fact of it's quite disrespectful to the likes of Sheffield United and Wolves when people say, oh, Sheffield United and Wolves are 6-8, so Liverpool are winning a shit league again, kind of like what happened when Leicester won the league. And it was, and I said this a few weeks back as well, all the other teams did shit because that was their chance to win it. No, that season Leicester were the best team, they deserved it, they were run close-ish. This season Liverpool have taken it on to a new level, and they've surpassed the standards that Man City have set for themselves over the last couple of seasons, and Man City are finding it hard to reach their own levels that they've set. So I still think it's a brilliant league to watch, and I think if you put on, if you've an option at the weekend of a Bundesliga game or a Premier League game, you're still going to want to watch a mid-table Premier Division clash than a Bundesliga game. I would think anyway, and I think it's worth noting that, like, because a lot of the teams, like I said, I think Chelsea are having a good season for them. There are other teams that are having good seasons for them. Yeah.
Okay, hang on now. You're saying that they're having good seasons for them, but is that like? That's not for the club. It's more for the club and the situation in which they find themselves, right? It's you know, they're in these rebuilding jobs and they're doing fine considering, but they're not doing well as the clubs that, or as they'd want to be doing.
Well, how well would Chelsea have wanted to do this season?
No, I know.
They could have aimed higher than...
No, I don't. But I mean, what I'm saying is that they're in the middle of these rebuilding jobs. They've just come out of this transfer ban, obviously, that they didn't take it. Well, they didn't get anyone, actually. But, you know, they'd want to be, you know what I mean? They wouldn't want to be the owners and their fans. They wouldn't want to be scrambling around about fourth place. They'd want to be challenging in general, you know, not taking the situation into account. Like, there's not many of those clubs who are where they want to be and who are firing in the way in which they want to be. That's what I'm saying.
There's definitely a few down there, Sam. You know, if you look at... I was looking at the stats on Arsenal this season, and again, there was a moment where the results were going a certain way, and they were back down in 13th as the league stood at one point over the weekend. So I think, you know, what Deck's saying there is right. You know, there was, you know, given the positions, given the scenarios, that they're in the likes of Chelsea, Spurs will probably take where they are. Arsenal probably excluded from that, because obviously 10th is just nowhere near where Arsenal should be finishing. But I just think there's such a big rebuilding job on a lot of those teams that it's kind of working in Liverpool's favour massively, not just this season, but sort of in the seasons to come, that we can probably, you know, build on this position. Because if you look at Arsenal, look at Chelsea, you know, I'd actually say out of all of the traditional top six teams, probably the best placed team at the moment would be Spurs. And only because they've got Mourinho, they've signed a couple of players in January. Okay, Eriksen's gone. There's a few players going, but you know, did they look like they've still got the nucleus of a very, very good team? They just need to add a few more players to it. Whereas Man United, Man City with an aging squad, Chelsea, Arsenal, they've got a massive rebuild to do. Absolutely massive.
Carl, have you got anything to add on that? Because obviously we've heard from the two Liverpool fans who obviously want to say that the rest of the league is very strong and that they're just even stronger. Is that the truth, or is there something in between, perhaps?
No, the league is really low on quality, I think, because it gives you so many opportunities to win matches. And as a Manchester United fan, you're looking at those, like, if you want the situation to change, which a lot of us do, and that means Ole Gunnar Solskjaer leaving the job, you look at the fixture list and you think, God, there's a lot of winnable games coming up here on paper against a lot of the Premier League sides, which will mean that if he wins the game, stays in the job longer. Actually, an example of that in the recent few weeks was I looked ahead to the next game and it was Burnley at home. And I was like, oh, well, we'll win that. And then he'll get a stay of execution. And then we lose 2-0 at home. And then he stays in the job anyway, which I think encapsulates the whole season, that there's just such a high degree of uncertainty. And Liverpool, and to a lesser extent Manchester City, are operating on a completely different playing field. Like, it's like a really high octane Scottish Premiership now, and they're Celtic and Rangers, and we're Kilmarnock. Like, that's
low. That's harsh on Kilmarnock and Hibs.
No, I meant they're under 23s, but I also think. With Arsenal and Chelsea, it's very interesting. Perception is everything. And Mikel Arteta has got a pretty easy ride so far, I think, from the media, because he's Pep Guardiola's disciple. And there's no doubt that Arsenal are much better organised now. I think only Liverpool have conceded fewer goals since Arteta's been in charge than Arsenal. But at the same time, only Sheffield United and Crystal Palace have had fewer shots. And in the 8 league games that Arteta's overseen so far as Arsenal manager, they've only won once, and that was against United, so that doesn't mean anything. And they've drawn 6, and they lost at home to Chelsea. So if you said that 8-game record under Unai Emery, there'd be holy war, you know, and AFTV would be in the 6 figures after an hour of being uploaded on YouTube. But I was I realised the other day after the Burnley draw at Turf Moor that I hadn't actually watched any AFTV since Arteta was appointed, because there's been no negative feedback from the club. So I said I'd watch it. And all the main hitters of Arsenal Fan TV were really positive about the Arsenal display. And it was 0-0 away to Burnley. And in Alexander Lacazette's failure to score away from home in the league is now over a year. And yet they were quite complimentary of how he was doing. So it's going back to my point, is that perception is everything, and the fans are happy with Arteta, but even though statistically he's not much better than Emery was.
I wonder, is that because you can actually see things moving in the direction? It's what we've been saying about United the whole time, is that there isn't a plan, whereas at least if you see a plan, it's something.
So I think it's a good thing, by the way, because I think I really, really hate the expression that football is a results game. Like, I know that, everybody knows that, but it's actually supposed to be entertaining, and there's supposed to be an idea behind it, as opposed to just winning at all costs. For a lot of teams, so I think Arteta with Arsenal is a good thing. But it's just interesting to me that everybody made up their mind about Emery. So if he had overseen this record of the last 8 games, there'd be huge feedback of negativity. It's the same for Chelsea. With Chelsea, there's a huge positive movement behind Frank Lampard, the opposite of which was Mauricio Sarri last year. And I think if you do come with them some sort of a plan, like anything at all, any sort of expression of play, usually what helps is if you play a lot of young players, that buys you a lot of time. And Lampard's done that better than Solskjaer. Solskjaer's played a lot of youth as well. But where the difference, I would say, between Solskjaer and Lampard, and it is perception, is that the way Lampard speaks in the media, he comes across like he has a clear plan. And I would say that Lampard himself, looks at what Solskjaer says and is like, I'm not going to make that mistake.
Yeah.
Because Solskjaer puts his foot in his mouth a lot, like a lot. He has a bit of a David Moyes syndrome. It's now already infamous after the League Cup semi-final first leg, when Manchester City battered us 3-1 at Old Trafford. And Solskjaer said, you know, we take great pride in the fact that City came here with their strongest team. It means they really respect us. You're never going to get Frank Lampard saying that. If the same thing happened with Chelsea, he would say, Man City are a great team, yes, but we want to do better. We're Chelsea Football Club, and we expect to be better than this.
Did you hear what he said about the Wolves game the other day?
Yeah, did they move the goal a half yard?
Oh, no, he was saying, you know, people are saying Wolves are very hard to play against. I mean, we've shown that we're a hard team to play against now as well. I mean, fuck off, man.
That's the thing that it really frustrates me too, and a lot of other United fans, is that what is frustrating about that is that a lot of other United fans buy that. They'll buy into that. And I think what he's doing is he's deflecting as much as he can. Like, Fergie was the best at deflecting when we lost. But of course, it was more rare on those occasions. I just think it's the way that people perceive Solskjaer now. There's so much negativity around them. I mean, a good example is the signing of Odion Ighalo. Like, United have a history of signing these stopgap players. We did it in 2007 with Henrik Larsson. We did my point is, we did it in 2001 with Andy Gorham, who was completely finished, and he came in as a keeper. But the difference is, back then, we were successful. And if you would completely trust Fergie, saying, okay, it seems like an odd signing for United, Andy Gorham, but okay, you probably know what you're doing there because results are good. But it looks so desperate when, in the same transfer window that you're after Erling Haaland, you end up with the Gallo.
That's so true. It's so fucking depressing. It's let's chat a little bit about what they can do, or what kind of jobs these clubs have on their hands, or is this, as Ansar suggested? Yeah.
Can I just say, like, when Cole was saying there, he was making the comparison with Arteta and Emery, and how, you know, there's a bit more positivity around Arteta, and then comparing that to United. You, Colm, you mentioned as well, though, that there has been a marked improvement in, certainly in Arsenal's defensive record since Arteta came in. And that's the thing that, obviously, as you said about playing youth and stuff, gives a bit more of a positive perception. But the fact that they've improved their defensive side of their game, straight away then you're saying, okay, I think when he came in and took the job, Arsenal were fucked anyway. You know, they were never going to get Europe at that stage. So it's a case of, no, what can you improve on? Show us that you can make improvements. We're not, like, what happened with Solskjaer is they went in, they had that new manager bounce, and they started winning games, gave him the job, and it's gone downhill from there. Okay, Arteta got the job permanently, fair enough, but he's showing a marked improvement in the way they're defending and conceding less goals. So now he's starting to bring younger players in, and, like, I was at the Arsenal Sheffield United game a few weeks ago, and the atmosphere was horrendous in the Emirates. But the fans, anytime Martinelli got on the ball, anytime Saka got on the ball, they were really encouraging towards those guys, but other players then not so much. But the fact that he's made those little improvements, and they're not getting, okay, they haven't shot up the table, they haven't gone on a big winning streak, it's probably better for him, because he's able to say, well, we're building something for next season, and there's a clear plan there, and it shows that the future may be bright if they keep building on what he's doing. Whereas with Solskjaer, on the other hand, there was an improvement in the results and all that, and then all of a sudden it started going shit. And now you can't say United are going to improve players, you can't say Solskjaer is going to improve players, and you can't say that there's anything that they've gotten better at as a squad either, really. So then when he makes comparisons to Klopp, like he did last week, saying, oh, Klopp finished wherever he finished in his first season with Liverpool, and he didn't get slated as much as I'm getting slated. The difference is there. Certain managers earn the right to not get slated in the first fucking 10 games or whatever. Like, Klopp came from Germany where he had success. Solskjaer has managed in a fucking shit league and done average. Like, yeah, he won a couple of leagues. He won a cup, but when he won the cup, they didn't even win the league. So then he's come over here. He's managed to get Cardiff relegated, and then he's the United manager. That's why people aren't giving you time, and they're saying that you're not making any changes, because you're not, and the team aren't getting better. Arteta's making improvements at Arsenal. You could see when Klopp got the Liverpool job, there was improvements in elements of the play. So the thing about, like, these teams being in transition, Chelsea are in transition, Arsenal are in transition, United are in transition, Spurs are in transition, but you can see improvements in all of them except for Man United. And that would be my biggest worry, as if I was a Manchester United fan. Like,
is the top four still, well, is the big six, or the top six, as people call it, is that still a thing, or is it really the top two? And then, you know, maybe some of those are better than the rest of the league, but it's still pretty open. Like, are those kind of you might say mid-level clubs, Wolves, Everton, that kind of thing, are they going to be more in the picture and competing for those other top four places?
It's always changed every couple of seasons anyway, though, hasn't it?
I mean, it hasn't. I mean, you know, these clubs, obviously, they have loads of money, but it even this transfer window has shown that money is starting to talk actually less, weirdly, because clubs don't have to sell.
The money's leveled the playing field, I'd say, Sam. Yeah, the big one for me was when we had there was two transfers. I'm not sure if it was the same window, and they really made me sort of typical. Bloody hell, that's crazy. It was when we had Benteke and we were trying to get rid of him, and Crystal Palace went, "Well, we've got 30 million. We'll give you 30 million." We were like, "Okay, for him, yeah, fine, that's great. Cheers, bye." And then I was gobsmacked at Crystal Palace. Gates of 20,000, if that. South London club without any sort of prestige, it's sort of to speak of. We're spending £30 million on players, and then Everton went and signed Sigurdsson for £45 million from Swansea, and I was like, bloody hell, this isn't even top six clubs.
Yeah, or even more, I guess even a better point of that is Palace holding out on Wilf Zaha. You know, they don't need to sell him for 50 million. They'll hold on for 80 or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I think like 10 years ago, 70 million or the equivalent of that kind of fee for Wilfred Zaha, Crystal Palace would have snapped your hand off for it because that would have bankrolled the club. But I guess the point I'm making is that kind of the sort of explosion in television money over the past few years is really only now, I think, starting to have that effect where sort of, it was the top four sealed up for years. Then Liverpool fell out, Arsenal fell out, City came in. And I think the top six did solidify again. But then I think you've seen that influx of TV money really has levelled the playing field sort of outside the top two. And Leicester are a wealthy club. Sheffield United have spent £22 million. Great sign on Sanderberg, in January. There's real money out there for these clubs if they wanted to go and spend it. They can because they know they've got that TV money. So I think the fact that Wolves can rock up at Old Trafford and Anfield and give you a very good game because they've got a superbly assembled squad, they can spend money aggressively where they need to. And I think that kind of has levelled the playing field to an extent where the top six isn't really definable. When you've got a season where Arsenal have won less games than Crystal Palace, what is the top six? You know, are Arsenal top six club? No, at the moment they're nowhere near. Man United is seventh. The gap between 10 clubs is about 4 points at the moment, so it could still fluctuate quite dramatically if a team can get on the run between now and the end of the season. Arsenal, in theory, could come out of nowhere and win a few games and get right up the table and make it interesting. Spurs have done it over the past couple of weeks and made it really interesting. I still personally think they could get into the top four this season. I think it's become really interchangeable, and that sort of levelling of the playing field through the TV money, I think, is only now starting to catch the so-called bigger teams out.
It's funny as well, you got me thinking there, and I wonder, you know, a lot of big clubs feel the need to sign name players or to kind of do these knee-jerk sort of reactions like United did with Solskjaer, or, you know, Chelsea did for years signing managers. And I wonder if, as you say, that there's this levelling of the playing field in terms of the keeping hold of players and buying the players that you want to get, maybe some of these clubs, like Sheffield United, like Wolves, having had to go out and buy younger or employ younger managers with new ideas and new kind of tactical innovations, maybe they might even have a slight upper hand in terms of, you know, the day-to-day running of the squad. Anything in that column, or am I talking shite?
I'd say there's another 10 years to go where the name and reputation of your club will continue to attract players. So if, we'll say, United, Chelsea, Arsenal and Spurs continue the way they are now, just for instance, imagine they had a transitional season for the next 10, then I think if the likes of Wolves and Sheffield United and Everton were to build on what they have now, then the next generation of players coming through wouldn't care so much about the established clubs and be like, well, Wolves and Sheffield United are playing great football and they're paying me pretty much as well as what Chelsea and Arsenal or United could, so I'll play for them. So that would be the only way I could see that changing. What are the odds that, say, United, Chelsea, Spurs and Arsenal won't improve over the next decade? Like, you would imagine that at least two of those four will get back to what they were by the time we hit 2030. Unless they continue to decline. You never know. Like, I mean, United are a club who basically specialise in failure, with the exception of two unbelievable stints under Matt Busby and Alex Ferguson. The rest of it, they're pretty average. And we could have another 30 years of that. So then someone like Wolves could take United's place. But I think we're a fair distance away from that happening yet. But the next generation of players, like, they probably won't care as much. I mean, I'm talking more generally here, but say if you're a kid coming through now and you're obsessed with football, 12, 13-year-old, you're probably going to consume most of your football through social media. And social media promotes the individual over the club. It's much more attractive. It's much more interesting. So I guess that the next generation of football fans coming through might not necessarily support a team in a diehard fashion the way our generation would, and instead will worship Jadon Sancho and Erling Haaland and those boys. And therefore, it'll be whichever team plays the best football, they'll aspire to join, as opposed to the established clubs. That's the only way I can see it changing.
Do you think though, Carl, sorry to interrupt you, but do you think though, like, I look at, you know, Sam Hughes, Sheffield United as an example of a team of an established way of playing and with coaches with innovative ideas. I mean, if you look at a player like, say, for example, John Lundstrom, say, you know, this time 12 months ago, you know, most football fans probably on the street wouldn't know who he was, but he's had a phenomenal season. And you look at what Sheffield United have done, he almost personifies it, because he's a player who's kind of floated around the lower leagues, and all of a sudden is there was talk of him getting England caps at one point this season, and he's done superbly well for Sheffield United. So maybe the attraction will be, if you are, like, you know, somebody like a Jadon Sancho or even like a middling pro, you know, and a coach comes in and says, well, I can work with you and I've got an established way of playing that is tried and tested. Maybe that attract, as you say, with the age of social media and that sort of projection of the self over the club, you know, maybe that will sort of have a role to play in the next few years. I agree with what you're saying. I think the reputations of the big clubs, where I think if there was a Sheffield United or a Manchester United chasing, there's only one real team at the moment who's going to win that. But I think if it carries on the way it is, these teams have an established way of playing. You know, I reckon if you picked a random Wolves player now, they would just wax lyrical about Nuno Espirito Santo and the benefits of his coaching and getting players. I mean, you only have to look at Adama Traore and where he's failed in the past with Middlesbrough and Villa after leaving Barcelona. And he looked like his career might go a bit west. And I still think there's a bit of hyperbole about him. But if you look at Nuno Espirito Santo and his team, his coaching team, there's a good group of coaches who got hold of him, looked at the finer attributes of his game and gotten an extra 10, 20% out that nobody's, like Tony Pulis, for example, at Middlesbrough would never be able to get out of him. So maybe that will come into effect in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think players have more options now, I think, with the way that football is. Like, football is so much more about systems now than it used to be. Like,
yeah,
I find that there are very few players nowadays who only have one position. One specialised position, especially attacking players. Like, you don't really have a right winger anymore. You don't have an Andrzej Konchelskis, for example. Like, if Konchelskis was playing nowadays, he'd be
in the free, wouldn't he? He'd be like the right-sided front three player.
He would be generally right side. I mean, like, what position does Mo Salah play?
Yeah, exactly. You know? And Firmino and people like that. Yeah, your right positions are dying, aren't they? Yeah.
So I think that if you're a player, an 18-year-old now, who has a certain amount of talent, but more importantly, a willingness to adhere and to buy into a system, that you have a brilliant opportunity to make it at a good level. And you have the commitment levels as well, because players nowadays, they look after themselves so well. They're like their brand, like modern day footballers at the top level, they're a brand themselves. They're very aware of their influence, or at least their management there. So they treat their body as their business, basically. Like, their body is actually their business. So they'll look after themselves really well. They'll adhere to a system that enables them to play at a certain level. And then they will just, generally speaking, play in several different positions within that system. And it'll be kind of, there's a less of an emphasis on the individual player. And there's probably now more than ever, because there's an obsession with managers. because we don't really have anyone else to look at. Because I think Liverpool are a great example that you have the three boys up top and they all kind of take their turns of being the main man. It was Salah 2 years ago. And it's been Firmino and Mane a bit for the last 12 to 18 months, more so. But more than anything else, it's Jurgen Klopp. That's who people go on about. It's Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah, cause of personality.
You have someone say, I like Deco laugh now because I'm always on about him, but say Ravel Maris in there, deadline day, drops down the league to the
Jesus
Champions.
Jesus Christ, you write one fucking article and you get like 6 months out of it.
he's like pinned in my head.
He tweeted
like,
him, man. He tweeted him.
He drops down to Middlesbrough and I don't see a way back for him for his type of player because he's too specific and he's too much of a luxury. You're not going to take your chance at him, you know.
You got him in there. Well done. Kind of one word or one team. Who out of those sort of rebuilding clubs is most likely to come out of that funk the fastest? Carl, I'll start with you.
Arsenal.
Deck.
Chelsea.
And you said Spurs already, right?
Spurs. Yep.
Spurs, okay, interesting. Good to watch that one. It was a quiet enough transfer window. You mentioned the Ighalo deal, and of course that Silva deal finally got across the line for United. But in general, were there any kind of ones that caught your eye, ones that kind of made you excited and that you'd be looking forward to?
Yeah, Danny Rose to Newcastle. More so because of what he said. Did you hear what he said?
No.
About Chippy or something.
Huh? Yeah, the Chippy was funny too. Yeah, he was on about... he's from the north, isn't he? And...
I think he is
Yorkshire.
I'm not sure, mate. He might be actually, yeah.
So he was kind of sick of London. He wanted to leave. Right? He wanted to leave Spurs for various reasons, but I actually think location was a big factor, and he wanted to move up north. So
typical
he was on about
Game of Thrones mentality.
It's so much better, options in Newcastle. But he was saying that he saw Willems get injured for Newcastle against Chelsea. Jethro Willems, the wing back, and he said as soon as he saw that happening, he rang his agent and said, "Get me to Newcastle."
Wow, that's amazing.
Which I find really bizarre. Well, first of all, I've always kind of suspected that players do that. So for a player to admit it, that's interesting. That must happen so frequently.
Yeah. I love how open he is. Great.
And the second thing is, why does he want to go to Newcastle so much? It's just bizarre. It's like you're going from the relative stability of Spurs to this chaotic club in Newcastle.
Who wouldn't want to play under Steve Bruce? anybody else?
Sander Berg to Sheffield United. I mentioned it before in me diatribe, but yeah, I think
sing a song, Ant. Go on, sing the song.
I don't know. Pete was going on about it before. I don't know what it is, but. He stumped me a little bit when he mentioned that on the group before, but I just thought he was phenomenal against us in the Champions League. What's the song, Deck? Go on.
I don't know.
Lies.
Bartlett.
Lies, yeah.
I don't have regrets singing Lies. So I saw it somewhere. I saw it on social media, I think, but I can't. I'm just on my phone.
Don't sing it. Kind of chant it. Just stand back from the mic and just shout it out in your kitchen or wherever you are.
You know what? I might be able to play it.
Go on.
He's no agent. He plays for a place with Johnny. We're playing in Europe next season. It's Sanderberg. He's no agent.
All right.
Okay, so that's actually Billy Sharp singing that as well. That's from a Sheffield United group chat or something that went out on social media. So
fair enough. Double points for that. I actually quite like that. Do you want to do a quick round of the quiz or do you want to skip it? What do you want to do?
Yeah. All right.
Quick round of the quiz then. Okay, usual rules apply. You are?
It's the only reason I bloody came on tonight. Let's get the quiz on.
All right. This player began his career at Porto.
Cullum. Deco.
Not Deco, no. Went from there to Falamichao. Never played for them. And?
Nuno Espirito Santo.
No. Went from there to Academica.
Deck.
Ant.
Deck.
Luis Bormarta.
No. Went from there to Ant. Porto. Again, Ant.
Ant. Youssef Chippo.
No.
Cullum.
Cullum.
Castina.
No. Went from Porto then to Parma.
Deck.
Deck.
Rui Costa.
No. Went from Parma to Barcelona. Went from Barca to Lazio.
Cullum.
No. Went from Lazio to Parma again, and that's where he finished his career. Oh, lads, have I stumped you?
Oh, fuck.
Who did he start with again? Porto.
Yeah. Started with Porto, but only played for them once. But he was there with his youth, played with them on the like youth teams as well.
When are we talking? What era?
Played for his first spell at Porto, like his main spell where he played 100 times for Porto was between 90 and 94. He was at Barca between 96 and 98, Lazio from 98 to 2005, and then finished up at Parma for 3 years, retiring in 2008. Has 110 caps for Portugal.
Who the fucking hell is this?
He is a... Nobody?
Deck. Nuno Gomes.
Not Nuno Gomes.
Ant. Abel Xavier.
No. he's a centre back.
Yeah, Cullum. Is this... I can see him. I don't know what his name is.
Oh, yeah, that's him.
Yeah, exactly.
Pantra.
No, but I think you're...
I can see him, like... Will I get it for that?
That's a drug ship.
No. let's see. He has won the Primeira Liga. He won that one 3 times. The Taça de Portugal, he's won that 3 times. The Super Cup of... Yeah, the Portuguese Super Cup, won that twice. Won the UEFA Cup with Parma. Won La Liga with Barcelona and the Copa del Rey twice and the Supercopa once. He won the Cup Winners' Cup once and the UEFA Super Cup once. All with Barca. Won Serie A with Lazio. Two Coppa Italias. 2 Supercopas. He also won the Cup Winners' Cup with Lazio and the Supercopa with Lazio.
What else did he win?
He won the Under-20 World Cup in 1989 with Portugal. And he was on the Portugal side that lost the 2004 European Championships final.
Did he play?
Yeah.
This is a disgrace.
Cullum?
Fernando Couto.
It's Fernando Couto. Oh, that's some top top Googling. Well done.
Fernando Couto, like, never even heard of him. He said he's the most football manager players where somebody retires and stats get regenerated.
He had 110 caps for Portugal. Would you go fuck yourselves? Like, right. I had good fun looking these lads up, I'll be honest with you. Right, the next one. Began his career at Kug.
can you say that again, please?
Kug. K-O with a line through it. G-E. Played for them 48 times before moving to Heerenveen.
Ant.
Cullum.
Ant.
Fernando Couto.
No. No. Couto. No. Cullum. Who?
Ruud van Nistelrooy.
No, it isn't. Deck.
John Dal Thompson.
It is John Donald Thompson. Very good.
Shout.
Very, very, very good. All right, point each. Let's get another one. This player began...
I seriously think you get Cullum a point for that first one, but he blatantly Googled it, are you?
Oh, well, fuck it. Was that or we just stayed here all night, like me finding random facts about him?
That's all you're annoyed about.
This next player began his career at Red Star Belgrade. Went from... Went from Red Star to Lazio. And Cullum.
Mihailovic.
Nope. And
Deck.
Bostovoy. Nope. Went from Lazio to Inter. And he was there for 9 years, and that's where he finished his career.
Cullum. Dejan Stankovic.
It's Dejan Stankovic, and we'll call it at that. You've won 2-1. That's it. I'll hang on to my other ones for next time. Just time to do a very quick prick of the week. Cole, start with you, seeing as you won.
Do you know my prick of the week, right, is the person who chooses that generic Premier League music that you hear at stadiums. It's usually like 5-3, right, when the teams are lining up. It always seems to involve Everton. Always Everton, right? So Everton's game at Watford at the weekend. I was watching it there in Match of the Day. And they just have this generic music. It's always in the lineups or shown on the screen, right? If you ever listen to it again, it's the most uninspiring music ever before you have a match. And they seem to play it at all the Premier League grounds. And I don't know why they play it.
Do they? Is it when they're coming out or like when they're lining up or what?
No, they're like on the pitch. And, you know, if
sing
you
it
watch
there.
Huh?
Sing it.
No, I can't. It's tuneless, Nick. It's tuneless. There's nothing to sing. Right?
So your prick of the week now is music.
I'm having to go with music in general. It's about time music, right?
It was taken down a peg, yeah.
But so,
lording it over, right? Poems for too long.
There's obviously someone made that decision that this is the music we're going to choose, and they chose that. Don't all go silent on me, right? You all know what I'm talking about. You all know this. You all know it. Like, I'll find it.
I'm just going to... Just gonna
six of the week, all of you.
Just gonna, you're not going to finish something else down
the phone, are you? Yeah, I'm just going to fade you out there, Cole, just for a second. Deck, what about you?
Fucking hell, I don't know. I've known.
Follow that one up.
Do you know who's a prick? Everyone who was given out about Jurgen Klopp devaluing the cup only for 23 to go and fucking win and get through to the next round anyway. You're all a fucking bunch of pricks.
Yes. I've missed Deck on this podcast. He's from solidarity here. Love it.
and what about you?
Can I go for a duo of pricks?
Go on,
Fernando Couto and Cullum.
I'm sick of music. I'm sick of high art. I'm sick of literature. No, I'm going to go for a gaggle of pricks from West Ham at the weekend. I don't know if you saw the sort of idiot's guide of how not to defend between Ogbonna and Issa Diop at the weekend for Brighton. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Deck, from a coaching perspective, like, I don't even know what they'd be coaching him there. But I mean, I wasn't a very good defender, but I just used to tell me the bloody thing out the ground if I panicked ever, you know what I mean? So it's just I don't know what they were doing. That sort of tame, sort of lovely cushioned back header straight into the path of Pascal Gross. You know, when you're down and you're in the shit, you do need your good players to step up. And I have no clue what they were trying to do there. And I just think they kind of personify how much of a mess West Ham are at the moment under Moyes and just how badly their season's gone. So just between them two experienced players, you should know a lot better. What a pair of pricks.
Fantastic. A good selection of pricks and, of course, the concept of music. That takes us to the end of the show. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back again next week, but there'll also be another 90s nostalgia pod in your feed as well. So if you haven't subscribed to us already, I don't know why you wouldn't, just go do that and it'll pop up every single time a new episode comes out. Also, go along to our friends at thefootballindex.co.uk, and if you sign up using the code FF20, you'll get a £20 bonus when you do it. Good. That's it from me. Just time to say thanks to Cole. Thanks, Cole.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ant.
Cheers, lads. Enjoy that.
Cheers, Deck.
Thanks, lads.
And goodbye from me. We'll see you next time.